On this episode of The Playbook, I have Tim Kobe, founder and CEO of 8 Inc., and the designer of the Apple Store. Tim and I discuss that design work alongside of Steve Jobs and how to focus on customer experience that leads to a monetary gain. Join me for all of this and more on The Playbook. This is Entrepreneurs The Playbook, where each week I bring you some of the greatest athletes, celebrities, and entrepreneurs to talk about their personal and professional playbook to success and what made them champions on the field and in the boardroom. I'm your host and CEO of Sports One Marketing, David Meltzer.
This is Dave Meltzer with Entrepreneurs The Playbook, and I have a legend, sorry, when we say that we feel old, but CEO Tim Kobe of both 8 Inc. and X8 Ventures, known specifically for what I think is the legend of design, of workflow design, architectural design, just an entire business design that is world-renowned. Your stores, specifically Apple and Coke, and the companies keep going. Specifically, I'm going to take it back. Because one, people, they look at our careers at our age and go, oh, how do I get there?
Yeah.
We wish we could tell them. But it's nice to learn your playbook. So where did you begin and where were your passions when you were younger?
So I probably benefited the most from the fact that my mother was probably an original hippie, but she's been an art teacher really since I was born. And I think she probably pushed us as much as possible, myself and my brothers, into the art field. My father, on the other side, was a sort of, you know, very pragmatic, very practical, hands-on type of guy. So we made a lot of stuff with my father, and we imagined a lot of things with my mother. So it was a combination, I think, of parental influence.
But that developed the left and the right side of your brain.
Yeah, actually.
And it looks like you need to use, and it's rare, you know, a lot of people are heavy set on one side or the other, and it's very rare to have such an equilibrium, but necessary in your field.
Absolutely. I think it's a huge advantage in design. I think it's also a huge advantage in business. When we were working with Steve Jobs at Apple, his, probably one of the reasons people found him difficult to work with was they would come in with something that was a very logical solution, and he could run through this logic tree, and if there was a bust, he'd find it and send you back to start again. But assuming you got the logic right, he would turn and then look at it from an intuitive perspective and say, well, it still doesn't feel right, even though the logic may be there. So people who are very strong in logic maybe would struggle, people who are very strong on an intuitive side, but unless you had that balance of the two, it was tough to.
Yeah, it's amazing. Bob Proctor, who's one of my mentors, and Bob is an intuitive, like, incredible, within minutes, can understand who you are through intuition. And, like, really pick you apart. He's done it for me and my media guy. Yeah. And you sit there, how do you do that? But then again, he's also a pragmatic business leader and thought leader in the fact that he can go down his logic tree as well. Mm-hmm. And I tend to start on the logic side, but have learned and developed the intuitive side. Do you feel as if you still can develop one or the other and keep on expanding? Even if you feel, you know, people program us. Mm-hmm. You could have been just programmed if you had a divorced parents as an artist.
Yeah.
But do you feel as if you still could have developed that logic side if you said, you know what, I'm going to work on this. It's a muscle. It's a skill. Is that true? Or do you think just innately you're built one way or another?
No. I think you probably start out with certain strengths, you know, certain muscles stronger than others maybe. But I think ultimately, at least in design, if you don't think about it as a lifelong learning opportunity, you will probably struggle in the business because everything keeps changing and you're always looking at conditions in a fresh way. So it's important to, you know, to be sort of agile in thought, be able to think about different ways of creating solutions. Ultimately, I think you need to be able to continue to develop that skill. That it's not something, okay, I've got my diploma, and I'm off to the races. I think it's a lifelong learning thing. It's actually what makes it great. You know, it's what makes it incredibly stimulating, and it makes you stronger each day.
And mentorship in my life is so important. I encourage the youth, you know, find at least three mentors, people that sit in the situation you want to be in. I was blessed to have someone who's almost on the spectrum, like our friend Steve Jobs, Lee Steinberg, I just milked for information. Could you share with us maybe a few things that you took away? You worked with Steve Jobs literally every week for 12 years.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is a genius level person, someone that's accessing information at a speed in which most people don't vibrate. What were a few things that you took away that, not that he told you, that you took away by observing Steve Jobs that were great lessons for you?
Yeah, I mean, we probably, when we were hired, we were probably hired from the benefit of having worked with another fairly significant individual, a guy named Robert Mondavi. He used to make wines in California, yeah. I'm sure you know. And what we learned was when Bob would interview somebody, he would bring in a marketing team and hear three pitches or four pitches, but he would always stop people in the middle of their pitch and say, you know, this doesn't really work for me. What else do you have? And the first time he did it, we thought, okay, this company is kind of missing the point. But in fact, he did it to everyone. And he did it to everyone to see how they think on their feet and to see how they respond to criticism. You know, it was much more sort of a character assessment.
Yeah.
And when we were hired by Steve, we started working on his on the Macworld events. We started launching the products with him. And I wrote a white paper on why they should do retail and gave it to them. And his assistant called one day and said, you know, Steve would like to see a capabilities presentation of your retail work. And he's in the car, he'll be there in 30 minutes. You know? And so you know, he shows up and he looks at the work, and we had done work for Nike and we had done work for the North Face, and he looks at it and the first thing he said was, what would you say if I told you I don't like this work? And my business partner, of course, he was like, oh my God, Steve doesn't like the work.
Right, and, ego conscious comes out.
Yeah, and you know, he said, none of this looks like Apple. He says, you know why should I hire you? And I said, because none of this looks like Apple. I said, this looks like what's right for Nike, this is what's right for the North Face, and what we've been doing for Apple for the last year is gonna be, you know, has been right for you guys. And so he sort of paused for a while and got up and thanked us and went out the door, you know. And at that time he said, you know, I don't know if you've done enough retail yet. And so shook hands and went out, and we said, so what does yet mean? Does that mean we're hired or not? So next day he called, and we started on a whiteboard sketching, you know, Apple stores.
Which are extraordinary. Now, through the evolution of skills and knowledge and desire, a brand sometimes takes on its own reputation. But you told me a story about, you know, not truly being hired off of just your reputation, which does happen, and mm-hmm. fair enough, it should. Mm-hmm. But you had a circumstance, I believe, in China where they went and surveyed all their favorite 100 workflow designs and mm-hmm. designs of retail stores all throughout China.
Yeah.
And they literally just hired you because of their top 100, almost all of them were yours.
Well, yeah, so this is a well-known venture capitalist in China. She's in the top 10. She has invested very heavily in retail, so she started in JD.com. But when we came to meet her, she said she did a survey of Chinese brands that she liked, that felt like strong international presence, and she wanted to interview the designers, but all of the ones that she had selected were ours. So we were hired, you know, come to Hong Kong and start working. So it was great that we had no idea that this was going on, obviously, but so far we've had a great relationship with her, working on her 100 investments.
That's amazing. Yeah. And, you know, speaking of adjustments, when you have a design, adjusting is so important.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think the strategy of asking someone, you know, what would you do if this, or stop, I don't like, because you don't know fully until there's people flowing through a store.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a plan for adjustment? So as you make the design, develop the design, is there room for adjustment within an Apple store when you first started?
So, you know, with any project, you want to prototype things. And so typically you'll prototype, you know, offline. It won't be out in public yet. With Apple, you know, prototyping in warehouses and things, getting buy-in from different people, getting insights from different people. Ultimately, you don't really know until you open the first store. And the night before we opened the first store, first Apple store, Steve was sitting on one of the tables, and we had just set everything. Everything was, you know, beautiful, ready to open. And he looked at us and he said, guys, what if nobody comes tomorrow? and, you know, we were sort of shocked that at that time he would be asking us that question. But you know, I mean, the reality was he was definitely concerned. You know, Bloomberg and other you know, well-known business pundits were saying this could be a big mistake, and he didn't want to really suffer through another impact on his career at that time. But you know, of course, next morning we had 4,000 people waiting in line or something, and it was great. But you know, there's always a bit of that anxiety when you first open, because you just don't know how people are going to react. The interesting thing was, we started the design of the second generation of the stores after the first year. And that was as much taking the learnings that we had from how people were interacting. We had incredible sales, for example, in the first flagship in New York.
And the number one retail store in the world, by the way.
Yeah,
that store.
It may not be, but
I remember
it
was the first time. I was one of the first people in that store, and I was thinking, and I didn't know you at the time. I said, oh my gosh, this is extraordinary. Like, who could think of this? Now I know.
it's a team of people working on every project. But when you get to the point of understanding what the initial reaction is to people, and we found we didn't have enough throughput, that we had more customers than we had retail touch points. And so we evolved that store, I think, two or three times in terms of the evolution of the interactions there, and ultimately went to the mobile payment processing, because we had too many people waiting in line. There's just too much volume.
Right, and the host. You went to the host system as well.
Yeah.
Right? Coming in,
that's
and
right.
Registering as a host, you feel like you're at a restaurant as well.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, in the end, you know, a lot of people romanticize what we do. Mm-hmm. I always say, you know, think about profit first, and then you can apply your passion and purpose to that profit and end up in the industry that you want. But, you know, when you do have the creative side, do you feel there is a conflict of, you know, this is about making money? Mm. Right, it's about drawing more people, getting the throughput with a higher ticket price, because people are emotionally attached, right? People bound emotion for logical reasons, and that's what I believe your designs do. I've been in the Nike and the North Face and Coke and all the different places. It's almost like Disneyland. Disneyland's design is an emotional design to profit.
Yeah.
Do you have some sort of focus on that type of profit of, you know, really getting down to how many registers and, you know, looking at that? Because in the end, that's what Steve Jobs wanted, right? To make money.
Well, ultimately, you know, as a retailer, you want to have conversions, right? That's the idea. But I think, you know, the approach isn't ever... where we would typically start, we say, look, our job is to design human experience. If you design human experience, you tend to connect at levels that build deeper relationships between a brand and a company, a brand and their customers. And when you focus on understanding what those values are and you communicate those through the touch points, you leave it up to people to make that connection. And I think there was already, when we launched the first stores, there was already a great, loyal Apple fan base, you know, and the customers were there, really understood what Apple was about, but the stores were the physical manifestation of that. And the experience component of it, if you look at the staff behavior, if you look at the communications, certainly their products and services, and the environment that you're in, all of those things are about communicating why Apple should matter to you. And if you can do that well, in other words, if you focus on the human outcome first, the business outcome always follows. Like we've never seen a case with any of our clients where if you provide the kind of experience that connects people to the brand, the transactions, the advocacy, the loyalty, you know, the forgiveness if you make a mistake, all of those things tend to work to your advantage, because it's about building less about a transaction and much more about the relationship.
It's interesting, because I was always taught by my mother, who's a teacher, you need to study history. And I'm like, well, history, why? You tell me not to stumble on the roadblocks behind me. Why am I studying history, Mom? And she said, because human nature never changes. Mm-hmm. And when I'm listening to you describe the design and the experience, and Starbucks had the same philosophy, Nordstrom's and a few other companies early on, really focused in on human nature.
Yeah.
Where did you learn that? You know, this show is about teaching people that playbook, and I think it's so essential to take someone with extraordinary success and say, you know, this came from somewhere. You know, where did you learn about that side of design?
I think it evolved. You know, certainly going through the process with Steve, his approach was always, what does this do for people? and then, you know, make it perfect, make it beautiful, make the interaction, you know, well designed. But it was what it does for people first as the starting point. And ultimately, if you think about creating value in business, any business, you create value because you're able to give somebody something that's unique, that's distinctive. If not, it's pretty much a commoditized thing, in which case the value creation is probably lower. But the idea that you're able to create something distinct and connect with people at an emotional level, you mentioned in retail, everybody says, you know, you buy emotionally and justify it rationally.
Yeah.
You know, that's human behavior. And, you know, we're emotional creatures. So the idea that you understand the things that, you know, create behavior, and you're able to offer those things in a meaningful way, you tend to get that traction. And so, you know, we would see and learn over the years with different clients and different projects that, you know, this piece is working, this piece is working, this piece is working. And ultimately, it adds up to you building a body of knowledge that you work with.
And that body of knowledge that you have, you now are launching a book in December.
In December, should be on
this
December.
Year, 2019.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you trying to accomplish with the book?
So many people have asked us about the kind of work that we're doing. So part of it is to show a body of work. The other part is to talk about what we're calling return on experience. So the book is called Return on Experience. And the idea is, what are the things that you get? Most people think of experience as kind of a soft thing. It's not, you know, it's not so tangible. And so we try to break it down into things that we look at that deliver, you know, these successful human outcomes. If you focus on those things, as I said, then the business outcomes follow. So it's really breaking those key points down. What are the kind of strategic things that we look at? So I think, you know, people who are maybe studying business, it could be interesting for them. Certainly people in design can start to see how these different ways of looking at the problem can lead to better outcomes. So, you know, it's sort of sharing that information.
I think every entrepreneur and business person should read that book, because I think at its core, whatever business, whether it's design or, you know, you're in the IT side of it, programming, I think it truly is about the emotional experience that you're connected to.
Yeah.
Because that's what's going to create a compulsive behavior to do two things: one, to come back, mm-hmm. or two, to tell somebody else about it, to share the experience. And that's free advertising.
Right, right.
Coming from the marketing side, yeah. I'm looking for that. Last question for you. You've been around so many different places and things, and I tell people all the time, like, how do I get a job in sports? Mm. And you're a classic example, because I would tell them, be the best that you can be, right? You have a consistent every day, persistent without quit pursuit of your potential, for whatever it is,
yeah.
right? And, you know, as you're at the art design school in Pasadena,
yeah.
nobody would think, oh, well, you're going to end up in sports. But in effect, because you are the leading designer for great retail, you're now actually designing for stadiums and arenas, and you probably have more access to more teams and leagues and organizations than people dream of, you know, trying to be Jerry Maguire. What's the number one, or who or what was the number one influence in your life to have, you know, that type of focus of, you know, I'm going to detach myself from the outcome. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to be the best, you know, to my potential of this kind of nuanced designer that you were? Because it evolves.
It evolves. I mean, I think, you know, you start out in design, you start out being critical. So you have to have some critical thinking skills develop. And, you know, you look at something and you determine whether, you know, this sketch is better than the last one, or it's worse than the last one. And I think, you know, you start to develop critical thinking skills pretty early in the business. The idea that those, you know, critical thinking is something that stops at some point, and you get sort of divine inspiration, it doesn't really happen like that. It happens from, you know, we always say design is a practice. We're still practicing.
Right.
We, you know, at some point we'll get better, right? But I think that this notion that, you know, it's a continuous learning thing, that you continue to approach the problem as if you can apply new thinking to it today. And, you know, I think that part of it is maybe just stubbornness and persistence. Sometimes when people say, you know, it can't be done, when people told Steve that the stores would maybe be a mistake and you should give the money back to the shareholders, you know, the notion that you don't listen to everyone. You know, you know, there's a portion of this that's intuitive. There's a portion of it that is what you believe to be right, and you follow that, and you learn from it. If it's wrong, it's okay. You know, you pick yourself back up and you keep going. But I think, you know, a big part of that is just thinking of it as part of a process. And you know, for us, design, as I said, it's a practice. We're always sharing that with everybody who works in our studios. You know, it's something that we're all in various states of development, but you know, it's something that really doesn't end as far as we can tell.
Well, it's been a pleasure to have you on the Playbook. You are the Picasso of retail stores. People, you know, they don't realize it, but your pieces of arts are all over the world. And, you know, here's the man, Tim Kobe, behind it. I appreciate you sharing your playbook to success.
Thank you.
Dave Meltzer with Tim Kobe here on the Playbook.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of The Playbook as much as me. On a personal note, I just wanted to thank everyone for making The Playbook such a success. Don't forget to continue it by sharing, subscribing, and listening to your favorite episodes. This is Dave Meltzer with The Playbook.